Tony Blair is having talks on the Iraqi crisis with Spain's Prime Minister amid deep divisions on the issue within Europe. President Bush has said he would welcome exile for Saddam Hussein. Four Asian men convicted of rioting in Bradford have had their jail sentences reduced by the Court of Appeal. A report on the use of guns by the police says that in most cases there's no need for officers to open fire. An 8-year-old girl has been killed by a falling tree in a school playground at Ashted in Surrey. Rail chiefs say the government won't meet its target of increasing train passengers by 50%. Tony Blair has arrived in Madrid for talks with the Spanish Prime Minister José María Aznar on garnering more international support for America's tough stance on Iraq. They're among 8 European leaders who signed an open letter declaring their support for President Bush's policy of disarming Saddam Hussein. But the letter has only highlighted disagreements over Iraq. Germany and France, who are opposed to military action, weren't invited to sign it. And Greece, which holds the European Union presidency, has attacked it as divisive. Tomorrow, Mr. Blair meets President Bush in Washington. Our World Affairs correspondent Peter Biles reports on the struggle to win hearts and minds over Iraq.
The letter, published in a dozen newspapers across Europe, was intended to demonstrate European solidarity with America over Iraq. It was the Spanish Prime Minister, José María Aznar, who initiated the article. Spain's spokesman on foreign affairs, Gustavo de Aristegui, explained the thinking behind it.
We were very worried about the tendencies that we have seen in the United States, that Europe and the United States were inevitably drifting away. And we do think that we have to preserve the transatlantic link. It's an essential part of our history here in Europe. And I do think that it would be extremely sad if the transatlantic link would be one of the first casualties of a crisis in Iraq.
But instead of bringing Europe closer together, this letter seems only to have highlighted the current divisions. Downing Street says President Jacques Chirac and Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder were not given the opportunity to sign because Tony Blair didn't think France or Germany should be allowed to speak for the whole of Europe. Greece has complained it was kept in the dark, and only 5 of the 15 leaders of the European Union put their names to the article. In the meantime, fierce criticism of American policy towards Iraq has come from the former South African president, Nelson Mandela. He said Tony Blair's support for President Bush had made Mr. Blair the foreign minister of the United States, although Mr. Mandela directed his anger primarily at Mr. Bush.
What I'm condemning is that one power with a president who has no foresight, who cannot think properly, is now wanting to plunge the world into a holocaust.
The coalition building for possible military action with Iraq may have begun, but there's no hiding the widespread disquiet over America's failure so far to present a credible case for war.
Tony Blair is now at the Spanish Prime Minister's residence in Madrid for talks with Mr. Aznar. Our political correspondent Gitto Hari is travelling with the Prime Minister and has just sent this report.
The Prime Minister's plane took off at 3 in strong winds and swirling snow, the most obvious display yet of an ongoing diplomatic mission to persuade Europe and the wider world to face up to Saddam Hussein. Tony Blair spoke briefly to President Bush this lunchtime by telephone. Tomorrow's meeting at Camp David will be a far more intimate affair. In Madrid, Mr. Blair is in good company. Prime Minister Aznar not only shares his outlook, but has proved his enthusiasm by persuading other European leaders to sign a declaration of support for President Bush. There are many countries, politicians and ordinary voters to win over. But the next 24 hours are designed to emphasize that George Bush and the United States are far from isolated.
As Tony Blair headed off on his latest diplomatic mission, 4,000 more British reservists were being called up for possible duty in the Gulf. 1,500 reservists have already been given notice that they may be needed should war break out with Iraq. Our defense correspondent Paul Adams has the details.
At the beginning of January, Jeff Hoon said the number of reservists called up would depend on Britain's evolving military plans. At that stage, efforts were made to secure around 1,500. He said further notices would be issued when they were needed. With the overall size of Britain's possible deployment to the Gulf now well over 30,000, the need for reservists has grown. The government now says it'll require as many as 6,000 part-timers from the Territorial Army, Air and Naval Reserves. With a large naval task force already in the Mediterranean and heavy armour on the move from bases in Germany and Britain, the final part of the picture, the deployment of additional RAF forces, is expected next week. This will include a variety of warplanes, reconnaissance and refuelling aircraft. The final tally of British forces poised to participate in a war will be around 40,000. Troops won't start arriving in Kuwait until the middle of February. The whole force should be in place by the end of the month.
This evening, President Bush has said he would welcome Saddam Hussein going into exile. Even at this stage, he said, the crisis could be resolved peacefully.
Hopefully, the pressure of the free world will convince Mr. Saddam Hussein to relinquish power. And should he choose to leave the country, along with a lot of the other henchmen who have tortured the Iraqi people, we would welcome that, of course.
In Baghdad, Saddam Hussein has been putting his armed forces on a war footing, promising to break the necks of his enemies. During a televised review of his army commanders, the Iraqi president said successive lines of trenches had been prepared and troops were being trained in hit-and-run tactics. Our correspondent Mike Waldridge is in Baghdad.
"I'm not afraid of announcing our plans on TV," the Iraqi leader declared. His aim, he said, was to rid Iraq of the Americans' evil intentions, and he'd be very happy if war didn't happen. But if it did, he said, America should know Iraq is not Afghanistan. He dismissed the idea that US-led forces would be able to fight in Iraq without meeting the stiffest resistance and suffering significant casualties. The tactic of having a series of trenches was to sap the strength of invading ground forces. Training was being given to all Iraqis, from shepherds in the desert to farmers, to deal with any troops being parachuted in. A commander who said his men had trained by walking nearly 50 miles with full kit in 17 hours was told by the Iraqi leader they would need to go faster than that if they were to infiltrate enemy lines successfully under the cover of darkness. Heavily publicized here, such speeches give the cue for some ordinary Iraqis also to express confidence in public that US-led forces would indeed find the going much tougher than has sometimes been suggested, though many people are obviously more anxious than anything else.
Four Asian men who took part in a riot in Bradford 2 years ago have had their jail terms cut by the Court of Appeal. Lawyers for the men claimed that the sentencing judge had failed to consider the background to the disturbances or the fact that the men had admitted their involvement. However, the court rejected claims that sentences of 4 to 5 years in 11 other cases were too harsh. More than 300 police officers were injured in the disturbances, which also caused damage put at £27 million. Our Home Affairs correspondent Danny Shaw was in court.
The 15 men who brought the appeals complained that their sentences were manifestly excessive. Most have been given prison terms of between 4 and 5 years, having been convicted of riot. Their lawyers argued that they'd surrendered themselves to police, pleaded guilty and expressed remorse. White men involved in disturbances 2 days later had been dealt with more leniently, they said. But Lord Justice Rose, who led the appeal panel, said deterrent sentences were called for. The riot, he said, was of the utmost gravity. It had been directed at police, many of whom were injured, even though they were trying to prevent trouble. All of the men were present for a significant period of time. Almost all of them had thrown more than one missile. Although four men won their appeals, including one whose four-year sentence was halved, the court refused to lower the sentences of 11 of the rioters, a decision which angered Sonia Khan, the sister of two of them.
"I thought that we'll find justice in Bradford, but we never found it there. So we come here, but I don't think there's any justice at all."
But Lord Justice Rose said it was unfortunate that the sentencing judge had remarked that he was not concerned about the origins of the Bradford riot. In the view of the appeal court, it was triggered by the stabbing of an Asian man. There was also understandable anxiety among Asian communities because of the presence of white racists in the city. A solicitor for the Asian men, Imran Khan, said he drew comfort from that finding.
"So that is something I'm incredibly pleased about, because it vindicates what the Asian community has been saying all along, that racists coming into the area, in effect, led them into the events that took place."
Mr. Khan said the ruling paved the way for future appeals and would help other defendants who've yet to be tried.
A new report on the use of guns by the police has suggested there's often no need for officers to open fire. The Police Complaints Authority, which investigated 24 shootings, says there are other, less violent ways of resolving some situations. Nearly half of the incidents investigated were in London, and the authority has asked the Metropolitan Police to review its tactics when it deploys armed officers. Our crime correspondent Neil Bennett reports.
This report dismisses any notion of the police in general being trigger-happy. They very rarely fire their guns when called out. But in most of the incidents when the police did open fire, they were confronting vulnerable individuals who'd been drinking, taking drugs, or had mental problems. One of the incidents investigated was the fatal shooting in 1999 of Derek Bateman. He was drunk and threatened the police with an unloaded air pistol. His daughter, Krista Davis, believes they didn't have to shoot him.
They could see the state that he was in, and they never gave him the time that he needed. If they'd have contacted any one of us, he was not horrible. He was so gentle, and any one of us would have walked straight into that house.
The report suggests that police could use other weapons to tackle such people: baton guns, stun guns, or water cannon, for example. The chairman of the Police Complaints Authority, Sir Alasdair Graham, wants the police to review the way they handle these incidents.
We do think there's need to develop tactics, to improve training, to deal with those particular situations, which were a relatively high proportion of the small number of incidents we looked at.
11 of the 24 shootings examined were in the Metropolitan Police area, a disproportionate number according to the report, even when London's unique crime problems are taken into account. But the Deputy Commissioner of the Force, Ian Blair, disagrees.
We deal with 1,100 firearm incidents a month. So out of the 4 years, we can expect to have dealt with 50,000 incidents. And to take 11 and say this shows a predisposition or a policy for rapid intervention just seems to us to be most peculiar.
As one possible way of reducing the number of fatal shootings, 5 police forces will take part in a trial of taser weapons, which stun suspects electrically.
An 8-year-old girl has been crushed to death by a falling tree in a school playground in Surrey. 3 other children were injured in the accident at West Ashted County Primary School near Epsom. The youngsters were about to go into the dining hall for their lunch when the Corsican pine crashed down on them. Lisa Hampley reports.
All afternoon, parents arrived to collect their children from the school, hugging them close and hearing their frightening accounts of what happened. Just after midday, the 8 and 9-year-olds in class 3 were queuing in the playground to go in to have lunch. 11-year-old Matthew Harrop said, suddenly there was a huge crack like thunder, like when the earth cracks open. A 45-foot pine tree had crashed onto the playground, just missing the building, trapping 2 little girls. One of them, 8-year-old Rihanna Davenport, died. Her sister also goes to the school. Misha Butler says broken branches rained down. She was terrified.
I just heard a big crack and all these leaves were coming tumbling down. I was frightened and scared. Everyone was running around screaming and some people were crying.
Misha's grandmother came to take her home.
Well, just sheer horror when I received the phone call. You only receive phone calls from school to the children not well. The last thing you expect is to know a tree's fallen on one of the classrooms, but just sheer horror.
3 children were injured. 1 has a serious leg injury. The other 2 were not badly hurt. The huge tree was completely uprooted. Health and safety officers have been at the scene, but as yet it's not clear if the bad weather played any part in the accident. Forecasters say there have been winds gusting at over 30 miles an hour in the last few days that could have weakened the tree. The school's head teacher, Jane Douglas, said Rihanna was a lovely girl and very highly thought of by everyone. The staff, governors and pupils are deeply shocked. The school's been closed until next week.
The Defence Secretary, Jeff Hoon, has announced that BAE Systems is to be the main contractor in a £10 billion deal to build 2 new Royal Navy aircraft carriers. A third of the workload relating to the design of the craft has been awarded to its rival bidder, Thales of France. Unions at British shipyards welcome the deal, but as our industry correspondent Hugh Pym reports, there have been questions about how the partnership will work.
A prolonged bidding contest between Britain's biggest defence manufacturer and a French rival has ended with a sharing of the spoils. The £10 billion deal to build and maintain the carriers will be carved up, with BAE Systems as prime contractor and Thales doing the design work. It's a big prize, as the Defence Secretary Jeff Hoon told MPs in the Commons.
These warships will be the largest and most powerful vessels ever produced for the Royal Navy, and at around 60,000 tonnes, about three times the size of our current carriers. They will rank alongside the most formidable and complex weapon systems deployed by any country anywhere in the world.
But opposition MPs sensed a compromise, a fudge, as the Conservative spokesman Bernard Jenkin put it. Ministers were exasperated with recent BAE defence contracts, which have run over time and above budget. Hints were dropped that the French company, which had promised to use British shipyards if it won the contract, might be in with a chance. But Jack Dromey of the Transport and General Workers Union claims that ministers began to think twice.
The start of last week, I believe that there was momentum in favour of Thales. I think that ministers have listened to reason, done the right thing.
There's certainly celebration at yards like Govan, Rosyth and Swan Hunters on the Tyne and Tees. 2,000 jobs will be created and 10,000 secured. But as to how these giant warships can be designed by one company and successfully manufactured by another is already the subject of speculation.
The body set up to oversee Britain's railways, the Strategic Rail Authority, has said that the government will now not meet its commitment to increase the number of people using trains. The government had wanted to increase the number of passengers by 50% over the next 8 years, but the SRA says improving the punctuality of existing services is now more important. Here's our transport reporter, Tom Simons.
The government has already said it won't hit its target to cut road congestion. Now its promises for the railways are slipping too. Instead of 50% more passengers by 2010, the Strategic Rail Authority estimates it'll be lucky to attract 35% more. So the strategy is changing. The problem is that running more trains has led to more breakdowns and delays on the system, and privatisation has pushed up the cost of improving track and trains. So instead of spending precious money to introduce new, fast services, the SRA is concentrating on improving what it's got. Today's decision to abandon a £4 billion plan to revamp the London to Edinburgh main line is a good example. Instead, a few hundred million pounds will be spent on improvements the authority believes can make a difference. Critics are worried it's a rerun of the cuts introduced by Dr. Richard Beeching in the 60s. But the chairman of the SRA, Richard Bowker, dismisses the comparison.
Well, I certainly didn't take this job to be the next Dr. Beeching. As far as I'm concerned, no one has done this to us. The industry itself has created a problem whereby costs have got out of control and performance isn't good enough. And it's the industry itself that will sort it out.
Mr. Bowker has made passengers some promises, among them the pledge that the oldest trains on the network will be removed within 2 years. Passengers will believe it when they see it.
Passengers on the London Underground will face weeks of disruption following the accident last weekend on the Central Line. Repair work on trains will keep two lines out of action until February the 13th at the earliest. There have been calls for congestion charging in the capital to be postponed. Here's John Moylan.
London Underground believes Saturday's derailment was caused by the failure of a bolt which secured a small motor on the underside of a carriage. The motor became detached, hit the track and derailed the train as it entered Chancery Lane station. So 11,200 bolts on 2,800 motors are to be replaced. It means no services on London's Waterloo and City and Central lines for 2 weeks, with only a limited service thereafter. It's understood that the Central Line, which handles 500,000 passengers a day, may not be back to normal for up to a month. The delays have raised questions about whether the start of congestion charging in the capital on February 17th should be postponed. Today, London Underground confirmed that it would be talking with the Transport Commissioner, Bob Kiley, about how the disruption would impact on the launch of the scheme.
The International Cricket Council has reasserted that England's World Cup match will be played in Zimbabwe. The team had asked for the match on February the 13th to be moved to South Africa because of security fears. But the chief executive of the ICC, Malcolm Speed, says they're satisfied with the security arrangements in Harare and that all matches will go ahead as planned. This report from Andy Swiss of our sports staff.
The ICC heard evidence from a new independent report into the current level of security in Zimbabwe. That report concluded it is still safe, and so England's match in Harare will go ahead. The ICC also confirmed that New Zealand would still play one match in Kenya, despite their fears of terrorist activity. Earlier this week, the England cricket team urged for their match to be moved because of both safety and moral concerns. but the ICC again emphasised it wasn't their role to make political judgments. But this may not be the end of the matter. This weekend, the ICC hand over responsibility for security to a new World Cup committee, and they may be more sympathetic to England's case.
The Speaker of the House of Commons has warned ministers not to allow government announcements to appear in the press before MPs have been informed. Michael Martin says MPs must hear important matters first. The Education Secretary, Charles Clarke, had to apologise after talking to the media about changes to university funding before he told MPs. First Minister's questions in the Scottish Parliament were interrupted this afternoon by demonstrators shouting slogans from the public gallery. It's understood they were protesting about possible military action against Iraq. They were escorted from the building by security staff. Trade union leaders have met the Deputy Prime Minister, John Prescott, in a fresh attempt to get peace talks restarted in the firefighters' pay dispute. The head of the TUC, Brendan Barber, said that ideas were now beginning to emerge to end the deadlock. Earlier, the General Secretary of the Fire Brigades Union, Andy Gilchrist, also met union leaders to bring them up to date on the dispute. Another 48-hour strike is set to go ahead this weekend, and the employers have refused to negotiate while there's the threat of industrial action. Here's our Labour Affairs correspondent, Stephen Cape.
The Deputy Prime Minister told trade union leaders that he wanted talks to resume under the original formula worked out by the Conciliation Service, ACAS. Nothing ruled in, nothing ruled out. John Prescott also tried to reassure them that the government's plans to reactivate a law giving ministers the right to impose a pay deal was not anti-strike legislation, but an attempt to encourage arbitration. The TUC leader, Brendan Barber, led the delegation. They went in with concerns, but they were quite happy with the outcome.
The discussions were very constructive, and a number of ideas beginning to emerge for ways of trying to move forward positively to try to reach a settlement of this dispute.
The TUC's role is now confidence building to get the two sides together. The firefighters leader Andy Gilchrist also held discussions with members of the TUC contact group of unions. Later he explained the next stage of the dispute.
We have a strike, as we know, booked with our employers, as it were, for 9 o'clock on Saturday morning. There's no plans at the moment to announce new dates, but as I've said, the executive are meeting on Monday and they'll look at the dispute afresh from there.
That'll be a crucial meeting, and Brendan Barber of the TUC will have a busy few days attempting to broker fresh talks.
Police in Surrey investigating the murder of the schoolgirl Amanda Dowler have matched DNA found on clothes taken from her home with a sample found at the scene of a church burglary hundreds of miles away in Sunderland. Detectives are now trying to find out who the DNA belongs to and why it was on the schoolgirl's clothing. Amanda, also known as Millie, was 13 when she disappeared from Walton-on-Thames 10 months ago. Her remains were discovered in woodland in September. Medical experts have called for changes in the way cot deaths are investigated following the Court of Appeal decision yesterday to free the solicitor Sally Clark. She'd been jailed for life for killing her two baby sons, but the court ruled that vital medical evidence hadn't been revealed at her trial and that her convictions were unsafe. Peter Hunt reports.
Sally Clark has been savouring her first day of freedom in more than 3 years. The case against her crumbled when it emerged the prosecution pathologist Dr. Alan Williams hadn't told the trial jury one of Mrs. Clark's baby sons had been suffering from a bacterial infection. The General Medical Council has said it's considering whether it needed to take any action against Dr. Williams. Those who work with the parents of cot death victims want changes in the way these cases are investigated. Joyce Epstein from the Foundation for the Study of Infant Deaths believes specialists should conduct the postmortems.
Research has shown that if somebody does the postmortem who is not a pediatric pathologist, that is a general or forensic pathologist, the diagnosis will be wrong in 20% of the cases. It's terribly important that somebody who really knows baby illnesses does babies' postmortems.
Sally Clark's success has inspired at least one other couple who believe they've suffered a similar fate. Angela Cannings was jailed for life last year for smothering her two baby sons. Her husband, Terry, says they believe their children were victims of cot death.
We both keep our feet firmly on the floor, not to get carried away, but to the same token, if it had gone against Sally yesterday, I'm sure we would have been dragging our chins across the floor.
His wife has appealed against her conviction and is waiting to hear whether it will be allowed.
Share prices in London seem to be recovering from last week's record slide, with the FT 100 index closing up 95 points at 35.79. On the currency markets, the pound was up a tenth of a cent against the dollar at $1.64, and against the euro it rose 1.5 cents to €1.53, making a euro worth 65 pence. On Wall Street, a short time ago, the Dow Jones average was down 53 points at 80.58. Hundreds of government documents released today have revealed more of the hidden truth about the abdication of Edward VIII. Historians have been mulling over the disclosures, the most startling of which is the revelation that in the mid-1930s, Edward's mistress, Wallace Simpson, was also courting another man. He was a car dealer by the name of Guy Trundle, noted for his good looks and prowess on the dance floor. More details from our royal correspondent, Nicholas Witchell.
He died in anonymity 45 years ago, but overnight the name of Guy Marcus Trundle has taken its place as a player in Britain's most celebrated royal scandal. According to the watchful eyes of the special branch, this son of a clergyman from York was the secret lover with whom Wallis Simpson enjoyed intimate moments at the same time as she was having her affair with Edward, Prince of Wales. A black and white photograph shows Mr. Trundle in a trilby hat and a neat double-breasted suit. A tall, slender man whose special branch characterised as a charming adventurer. But Mr. Trundle's sudden emergence as one of the more celebrated lovers of the 1930s has come as a complete surprise to his family. His sister-in-law, Pauline Trundle, told reporters the story shocked her.
Yes, it does. Well, if it's true. If anyone had a relationship like that.
Among the many questions being pondered by historians is who put the special branch onto the Prince of Wales, and did anyone tell Edward that the woman with whom he was obsessed and for whom he gave up the throne had been cheating on him? The Queen's biographer, Professor Ben Pimlott.
First of all, why he was put under surveillance and who put him under it, whether it was the Prime Minister or at the King's request. Who did the government report it to? Did it report it to King George V? And if it didn't report it to the Prince of Wales, why not?
It may all have happened very nearly 70 years ago now, but the story of the abdication remains as compelling and curious as ever.
Motorists are facing hazardous weather conditions as heavy snow sweeps across the country. In the northeast of Scotland, where police have described driving conditions as horrendous, thousands of drivers were trapped in their cars for more than 5 hours and more than 100 schools were closed. Forecasters say the snow will continue in some areas for another 18 hours. Here's Jane Waugh.
In the northeast of Scotland, thousands of drivers have been trapped in a 12-mile tailback on the northbound section of the A90 south of Stonehaven. Grampian police say officers in four-wheel drives are escorting convoys of cars to part of the road that's been cleared. In the Lawrence Kirk area, three trains were trapped for about 3 hours. The blizzard conditions have put some snow ploughs and gritters out of action, and police are warning people not to drive unless it's absolutely necessary. More than 130 schools in northeast Scotland are closed, including all the schools in Orkney. Blizzards in North Yorkshire caused a 20-car crash on the A19 in this morning's rush hour. Police said all the roads across the Yorkshire Moors and along the coast had been affected by the snow. In Lincolnshire, 10,000 people have been left without power, and about 30 schools have had to close. There have been a number of accidents on the M40 in the Thames Valley region, with cars spinning in the slippery conditions and lorries jackknifing.
Radio is continuing to attract more and more listeners according to the latest audience figures. Research for the official Radar organisation shows that Radio 4 continues to attract almost 10 million listeners a week, with the Archers audience being boosted by the gripping storyline involving Brian Aldridge and Siobhan Hathaway. Our media correspondent Torin Douglas has more details.
The Archers attracted almost 5 million listeners a week last autumn as the complications of Brian and Siobhan's affair unfolded. 130,000 extra listeners tuned into the Sunday Omnibus edition, and the total Archers audience was second only to that the previous autumn, when Radio 4's listening reached record levels in the aftermath of September the 11th. Today's figures show the network's total audience, at 9.8 million a week, was slightly down on that period, but it remained the most popular station in London. And Radio 2 extended its lead as the UK's most popular station, with more than 13 million listeners a week. The figures also show an increase in the popularity of radio as a whole. It attracted an extra 1.75 million listeners a week in the past 3 years. And more people are listening via the internet and digital television sets. 12% of listeners now say they've tuned into a station online, and 16% via the television.
Police in Germany are hunting a circus director who's gone on the run. He shouldn't be hard to spot. He's taken one of his elephants with him. The man disappeared when the authorities withdrew his license to keep elephants. The main news again. Tony Blair is in Madrid for talks on the Iraq crisis with the Spanish Prime Minister, José María Aznar. Both men and six other European leaders have signed an open letter backing America's stance against Iraq. France and Germany did not sign. BBC Radio 4 News.